The Tom Woods Show, episode 471.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. You know what I love? Getting paid for things I'm going to do anyway. So I just joined Ebates because I get cash back for purchases I'm going to make anyway. Sign up through tomwoods.com/Ebates and get a free $10 gift card. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods with Tom DiLorenzo today, talking about government and wage rates, but primarily about fringe benefits. Why shouldn't the government mandate X number of sick days and vacation days and family leave and so on? What could be wrong with that? We're going to talk about that and labor unions and more today. Tom DiLorenzo, of course, is professor of economics at Loyola University in Baltimore. He is the author of numerous books. I will link to several of them on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/471. They include How Capitalism Saved America, The Real Lincoln, Lincoln Unmasked, Hamilton's Curse, and Organized Crime, The Unvarnished Truth About Government. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Pleased to be with you, Tom.
I'm doing a series of episodes in which I'm not necessarily each time going to mention Bernie Sanders' name, but the types of ideas that he's putting forth are great episode topics because they need to be refuted. I mean, we need to spend more money really developing wind power. I mean, come on now, right? But people do need to know what to say to that, and so I'm going to try and get to that in the coming week. So when I heard the Sanders proposal to give people, I guess it's 10 paid vacation days and 7 sick days and 12 weeks of family leave, I thought Tom DiLorenzo is very good at stuff like this. So that's the sort of proposal that strikes people as benign and very much welcome and could only be for the good, and that the only people who would oppose something like that would be fat cats who are in bed with industrialists who just want to grind workers' faces into the ground. What is the libertarian way of understanding a proposal like this, on the other hand?
Well, another group of people who would object to it is anyone who has studied economics for 5 or 10 minutes. Because basically, this is basically the European model. It's basically the reason why for many decades, during the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, there was zero job growth in so many of the Western European democracies, because all of this priced people out of a job. You can't give people something for nothing. You know, it'd be nice if we could all have 3 months of paid vacation or family leave or whatever you want to call it. But of course, that costs a lot of money. And so if you have somebody who makes, say, $500 a week, and he produces for his employer $600 a week by being there, well, then it's worthwhile to employ that person. But if the government comes in there and says, well, in addition to paying this person $500 a week, you have to pay him another $1,000 a week in fringe benefits, that person no longer is going to have a job. And that's exactly what the European Socialist parties advocated for many decades in the post-World War II era. And, of course, they came right out and called themselves French Socialist Party, the Belgian Socialist Party. You know, they didn't call themselves Democrats or Independents or, well, I don't know, I'm not sure what Bernie Sanders is calling himself these days, but they came right out and said, we're socialists and this is what we stand for. And of course, Bernie calls himself socialist and this is his program. And so it is a surefire recipe for a huge spike in unemployment in America and poverty.
Well, what I find to be a complete home run argument against not this specific proposal, but any such proposal, is that when you compare it to what he would say about carbon emissions, you see that on carbon emissions, he realizes that if you make something more expensive, people will do less of it. That's his whole plan against mm-hmm. carbon emissions.
Yes.
Well, likewise, if you make employing people more expensive, why wouldn't they do less of that?
Yeah, sure. Either he's confused or he's sly as a fox. It reminds me of a story my old friend, the late Murray Wiedenbaum, once told me when he had a conversation with Barry Commoner, who was an old sort of socialist environmentalist. And Weidenbaum, the old Professor Weidenbaum told me, he asked Barry Commoner at lunch one day, they both taught at Washington University, St. Louis, well, you're against coal-fired power plants, you're against hydroelectric power plants, you're against nuclear power, you're against all these different kinds of power, and that would destroy capitalism, wouldn't it, if you didn't have any of this? And he said Barry Commoner just smiled, and you know, that's the idea, of course, yeah. Destroy capitalism. Yeah. And so maybe that's what Sanders is up to. He understands that this would create massive unemployment, massive poverty. And that's the Francis Fox Piven strategy, isn't it? If you've ever read about that, to sort of overwhelm the welfare state so much that the government will have to come in and adopt full-blown socialism, eventually. And so that's been a strategy of the hardcore socialist left for many decades now. And Bernie Sanders is their man.
I remember giving a talk at the Mises Institute years ago, and Morgan Reynolds was there. And, of course, he was a professor. Was he at Texas A&M?
Yes, he was a professor at Texas A&M for many years. He was also the chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor in the first Bush administration.
That's right. I was going to mention that. So he knows a little something about labor economics. And I was giving a talk related to my work on Catholic social teaching and talking about all the myths that need to be overturned there. And he got up and objected at the end and said, I'm sorry, I just don't accept the idea that this is just a question of people of goodwill who just have some mistaken pronouncements. That he said, I'm sorry, there's been too much progress in economic science for anyone still to believe this stuff, that the way you help people is by making it more difficult to employ them. I don't believe that. So I believe, until proven otherwise, that anybody advocating a policy like this is a sinister person who wants to keep people in poverty, because I can't believe anybody could be that ignorant. Now, that really was a stunning thing to say. Now, I personally think people can be that ignorant. I think there are some malicious people. I also think there are some ignorant people. But that I took as a really stunning kind of rebuke. Like he said, Ted Kennedy had to know that he was not improving the situation of people, but what he was doing was making sure they would always stay down and poor and dejected, and they would always stay Ted Kennedy voters. That's what he was accomplishing. So that was, a real shock to hear somebody say that out loud. And my sort of response was to say, I even find some economists these days talking about raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. If the economists get it wrong, I think we can be a little bit more understanding when some clergymen get it wrong. None of them should get it wrong to start with. But these days, Tom, on this subject of the $15 minimum wage, you even hear people like Krugman kind of suggesting that maybe that might not be such a bad idea. Now, this was one of those areas like free trade where all economists agreed, no matter what school you were from, and now that consensus is breaking down. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, another socialist economist, Joseph Stiglitz, who agrees with Krugman on most things, when he worked for Bill Clinton, he wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal where he said what he says in his textbook. He said raising the minimum wage will create unemployment. And I can remember this old article from the Wall Street Journal where Joseph Stiglitz said, we've calculated that if we raise the minimum wage the way we would like it, we would lose about 400,000 jobs. And so he admitted that. But he said, but then we have social programs. We have welfare. We have government job training. And we can take care of all these people that way. And so there's a political calculation there, too. He was thinking, well, the unions want this, because the unions like to price out of a job anybody who competes with union labor, which is a lot of low-skilled labor does. And so they would win a lot of political votes and money from the labor unions by creating massive unemployment among mostly teenagers. And at the same time, they'll win even more votes by giving those same teenagers welfare. At the same time, so it's all win-win for the state by creating unemployment and poverty. So at least the politicians who run the state anyway.
Well, on this just general subject of fringe benefits that Bernie Sanders is talking about these days, among other things, I remember an article you wrote about the bumper sticker that we see about labor unions brought you the weekend. And yeah. I loved your analysis because it's just like a laser beam. Explain, why do they say that labor unions brought us the weekend, but what in fact did bring us the weekend? That is, 2 days off in the 7-day week.
Yes, well, over the years, over the century and a half or so, we've seen people working fewer hours but making more money and working at the same time. And how could that be? How could you work less and make more money? Well, the answer is increased productivity. People work, you know, they produce more per hour. And the main ingredient of that is capital investment by entrepreneurs. When the employer buys a new software system, a new computer system, or an agriculture, the latest agricultural technology or something like that, then the people who work with that technology become more productive. They can produce more output per hour. And employers have to compete for these people to run their machines, to operate their computers, and so forth. And how do you compete for good employees? Well, you have to offer them a little more money. So that when productivity goes up, wages go up. You know, we've been observing that for centuries now. It's not an exact one-on-one relationship, but it's the correlation has always been there. And so productivity improvement is the key to that. That's how what we have done. And the number of labor hours going down, the reduction in child labor, and things like that. That all happened before labor unions did anything, before there were laws passed, you know, limiting hours or forcing employers to pay time and a half for overtime, as it occurs in some states, and things like that. So it was capitalism and technological development and capital investment under capitalism that is responsible for the more weekends and more leisure time.
I always give this example because it's from my immediate family. My father was a member of the Teamsters. He was a forklift operator in a food warehouse for about 15 years. And I sometimes think about the wages he was able to earn. The Teamsters could have protested all they wanted about wages before the invention of the forklift, and it wouldn't have done any good. There's no way they could even have remotely dreamed of getting the type of wage they were demanding unless the forklift existed and had been invested in by the food company saving and reinvesting its profits. There's no other way. How could you imagine the difference in productivity trying to move pallets of food with your bare hands as opposed to with a forklift? It's not even worth thinking about. So there's no way he could have earned that wage otherwise.
That's exactly right. And or look at farm labor, you know, some guy walking behind a horse plowing a field, and then the tractor is invented. And you can plow 100 times more per week with a tractor compared to walking behind a horse. And that has nothing to do with the improved skill of the worker. But all of a sudden that worker becomes farm worker becomes much more valuable to the owner of the farm because he can produce so much more. And if he's not there, you know, the farmer loses a lot more because he can make a lot more because of the increased productivity. And me and my father was a unionized iron worker. It was just sort of the same thing. They took advantage of the skill and technology of heavy construction. And you know, not everyone can do that or is willing to do that either. And that's another thing about capitalism, by the way. These jobs like that are very strenuous or dangerous, you have to pay what economists call a compensating difference. You have to pay people more for these kinds of jobs, and so they do. And so that's how people like my father were able to make a good wage. They were willing to take on these strenuous and sometimes dangerous jobs because they got paid more than other jobs for doing that. That's how the market works.
Somebody might well say, though, that a labor union clearly benefits its members. Those members earn more than they would have without the union. So this is a good thing, therefore, and it would be an even better thing if we could spread labor unionism even more and more and more throughout the economy to cover more and more workers so everybody could enjoy the benefits of labor unionism. Is there a fallacy in there?
Yeah, the fallacy is that the competition for labor unions is always non-union labor. Now, the only way a union can get wages above the free market level is to use some sort of force or coercion or intimidation to keep competition out. For example, the strike has historically been the tool that labor unions used. But if you go on strike nowadays, you risk losing your job because it's not illegal to hire replacement workers. So that's a very risky thing. And so another thing, you mentioned Morgan Reynolds, the labor economist Morgan Reynolds. One of his articles that he wrote, kind of memorable to me, when he was the chief economist at the Department of Labor, was on union violence. And there's been a lot of research on this, and that historically in America, unions have used a lot of violence, you know, clubbing, stoning, dynamiting, slashing tires, vandalism, to intimidate. It's all directed at non-union employees who they call rats and scabs and much worse than that. It's not really directed so much at the employer. The competition is always in the employees. And so any gains that unions make are usually at the expense of non-union employees. That's why they lobby for such things as the minimum wage law, because it prices out of the market, helps price out of the market low-skilled labor. The way I teach it is I tell students, if I hire two college students to pay my house and pay them $10 an hour each, that's $20 an hour, but I can pay a union guy who's a skilled, you know, older, experienced painter, $25 an hour. Well, I can pay the two college guys the same less and get the paint job done. But if they have a law passed saying I have to pay them $15 each per hour, then it's no longer economical for me to hire them. And it now costs me $30 an hour for them and $25 an hour for the union guy. So I'm going to hire the union guy. And the unions understand that. This is not rocket science. And so a lot of what they do politically also is aimed at getting non-union labor out of there. Child labor laws, the unions, when the unions got behind that, it was because young people were competing with unionized labor. And when you see them protesting so-called child labor in Indonesia and places like that, it's not because they love children in Indonesia. It's because they want to throw them out of work. And in parts of the third world where children are thrown out of work because of boycotts or something like that instigated by unions, the alternative is not enrolling in a nice, expensive private school. The alternative is begging on the streets, child prostitution, crime, things like that. And so a lot of American unions are perfectly willing to destroy the lives of thousands of third world children who might be working in a textile factory to make a little bit better lives for their families.
It's interesting that so many people who would describe themselves as having progressive views on race are also very much pro-labor union, when the labor unions very obviously were making life very difficult, especially for American blacks throughout their heyday. And of course we can see that in South Africa, just all over the place what the unions were up to.
Yeah, well, in South Africa, you know, our friend Walter Williams wrote this book called South Africa's War Against Capitalism about 30 years ago or so. And he points out there that the apartheid system was partly enforced by South African labor unions who instigated that system in the first place. And they were very Marxist-oriented. And their slogan was a variation of the old Marxist slogan, workers of the world unite. The slogan of the white racist labor unions in South Africa was workers of the world unite, keep South Africa white. And by that, they meant don't provide employment opportunities for black people in Africa. And in the United States, just from my personal experience, I said my father was a unionized iron worker. And I knew that it was virtually impossible. Like growing up in Pennsylvania, it was unheard of for a black man to have one of these higher paid skilled jobs back in those days. And it was solely because the labor unions did that. And in fact, an old student of mine, a long, long time ago, Tom Rustici, who I think he still teaches at George Mason for a while. And as an undergraduate, I got him to write an article for my class that I got published in the Cato Journal, where he looked up the congressional record at the time of when they were debating the original minimum wage law in the United States, and he found that some politicians, members of Congress, came right out and said, well, we've got all these black workers from Alabama who are willing to work less than the white workers we have here, and we can't allow that to happen, so therefore we want this minimum wage. They came right out and said that the minimum wage law would be a tool to discriminate against lower skilled black workers in the United States. And that has always been the effect of laws like the minimum wage, if not the intent.
Let's pause for just a moment for this message. Hey, everybody. As somebody who earns his living primarily online, I have become extremely interested in all the creative and clever ways people can earn money online. Well, maybe the easiest way I've found is through a program that I myself use called Ebates. They pay you for existing. Well, not quite, but close enough. They pay you for shopping that you're going to do anyway. They give you rebates for shopping at almost any online retailer you can think of, 1,800 of them to be exact. And I use the Ebates button. You don't have to do this, but you can install a button on your browser, and it'll light up and tell you that you are at a vendor that participates in the program and will give you cash back pretty much for existing and clicking. So don't leave free money on the table. Go grab it at tomwoods.com/ebates and get a $10 gift card free. So when the average student is sitting in a classroom and believes that the reason that wage rates have risen in over the course of American history has something to do with labor unions, and you've got 30 seconds to explain to them why this idea they've taken for granted their whole lives is incorrect, how do you sum it up?
Well, you say labor unions have never been more than about 30% of the United States labor force. So just that fact alone means that they cannot possibly explain all of the increase in wages. And also, if you understand the simple economics of it, you understand that when unions do succeed by pushing wages up, then there's a downward sloping demand curve for labor. That means that employers can no longer afford to hire as many people. And it's usually the people of least seniority, the least skilled, who are labor union members who lose their jobs. And so some labor union members actually get priced out of a job whenever the wage goes up as a result of the efforts of unions. And then also the union has to keep out of employment competing non-union workers. And so whenever unions benefit, it's only for the benefit of some of their members, but it's at the expense of some of their other members and also of non-union labor. And that whole idea also ignores the fact that it's really capital investment that drives productivity. And labor unions have been a drain on productivity with feather bedding laws and that sort of thing that forces, well, just look at the American automobile industry and the textile industry and the steel industry in the 1970s. Labor unions were mostly responsible for their destruction.
Our friend George Reisman thinks of it this way. He says, when a labor union gets involved, the whole point of it is to raise wages, which means that there'll be fewer people employed at that rate. So some people have to drop out and go into some other line of work in a heavily unionized industry. But that some other line of work is obviously, from their point of view, inferior to the first line of work they were in, or they would have chosen it in the first place. So now you get a whole bunch of people who have to go down a level in terms of their ambitions for employment. And at that level now, there's an artificially increased number of people competing for those jobs, so wage rates are depressed in that area. And if you unionize there, you drive some people out of that, and they have to go down a level. And so those people lose, but also all of society loses, because all those people who are being pushed out are people who acquired skills, spent some time and resources acquiring those skills. They can't use those skills because the union drives them out of the industry. So society loses as a whole because all the resources that went into providing those skills to those people are a complete waste. So these are all things that are totally missed when all you look at is, hey, here's a labor union and some guy now has a higher wage than before. You have to be able to think beyond this surface level. It really is the broken window fallacy that it's what is seen and what is not seen. You have to look for what is not seen when it comes to labor unions.
Yes, exactly right. And it's not that complicated. If you understand basic supply and demand as applied to labor markets, I think most students that I talk to catch on very quickly because it's very straightforward, very logical thinking. But if you only listen to emotional rhetoric, as your typical voter does, well, then you're easily duped by all of this. But that's exactly what happens. Wages in the non-union sector are depressed. If you create hundreds of thousands of unemployed people, a lot of them are going to find jobs in the non-union sector, and that'll drive wages down there also. So people who already have jobs there will find that either their wages will fall, or at the very least, they won't rise anymore. They won't rise as fast as they otherwise would have in the future.
Tom, I'm going to link on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/471, to your article on labor unions and the weekend. But is there anything else that you can think of either in a book of yours or in an article that would be interesting to accompany our discussion today?
So I have three or four articles on Mises.org or LouRockwell.com on labor unions. I have one on safety. There's one on how it's markets, not unions, that have provided job safety also. And the point I make there is that if you have a dangerous workplace, employers have to pay you more money to work there because you're taking a risk. And so therefore, that provides a financial incentive for employers to make the workplace safer because they can make more profit by having a safer workplace. And so, and that has been going on for many decades before OSHA ever came around. And so, and I can send you those also.
Well, I'll dig those up myself. I knew I had read other things from you. I'll also link to a really long piece that Morgan Reynolds wrote, kind of a history of labor unions from the colonial period up through the present. That's also on Mises.org, and that'll be useful for people.
Yes, I have an article on union violence also on Mises.org.
Okay. All right. We'll definitely make sure and put that in there. And I have a chapter in 33 Questions About American History that gives some of the specific examples also of the labor union violence. I'm sure you've got it in your article. So I'll put all this up at tomwoods.com/471. Tom, thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Okay, my pleasure. Have a good day, Tom.
All right, everybody. Remember, we are so close to another school year. And if you're thinking of signing up for the Ron Paul curriculum, which will help you homeschool your kids without losing your mind, by the way, will save you enormous amounts of time, then check out ronpaulhomeschool.com. That's my special landing page. With $140 worth of free bonuses, you can't get anywhere else. If you're going to join the Ron Paul curriculum, check it out there and join it through that page. I make a pretty persuasive pitch on that page, by the way, for how you can get your mental health back, get your household back in order, not be running yourself ragged, and be getting an education for your children that the rest of us would have given our right arms for. So check that out at ronpaulhomeschool.com. And remember, if you want free publicity for your blog, if you have not started the blog yet, but you're thinking about it and you'd like to get a little free publicity out of the gate, I will do that for you, but you've got to check out how to do it at tomwoods.com/publicity. Give me a couple of weeks after your blog is up and after you've contacted me, and in one way or another through social media and elsewhere, I will get some information out about your blog. So make sure and do that. Join us out there trying to change the conversation. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.